Blog Talk Radio.
Nasruddin once gave his student a clay pot and told him to go fetch some water. Then he slapped the student. "Ouch," said the student. "Oh, master, why did you slap me?" Mulla replied, "I did that in case you should break the pot." "But master," said the student, "I haven't even gone to fetch the water yet, much less broken the pot." Mulla said, "So much the better that I should slap you now. For what good would it do me if I should slap you later after the pot is broken? It would be too late then." Greetings, all you beautiful listeners out there. And welcome to Zariana Radio. This is your host and confounded storyteller, Evan Poss. And I am here in the studio live with engineer and producer Daniel Michael.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this lovely Thursday at 11:03 or whatever time it is, depending on what part of the world you're in, of course, because this is internet radio, which is worldwide. So welcome to Thursday, and welcome to Zariana Radio.
Yes, for those of you in Kathmandu right now, I can't imagine it'd be 11:03. For those of you listening from the West Coast, it's probably about 8:03. And for all of you lovely listeners out in other unknown parts, I want to welcome you to the show. We do have quite a show lined up for you today. The theme for today is humor and absurdity in folklore and spirituality. And so we do have some interesting stories from a variety of traditions. A Sufi story, which you just heard, the timeless humor of Mulla Nasruddin. We have some Indian folk tales, as usual. Some Japanese folklore and some folklore from Africa. And I'm going to pass the floor over to Dan for a minute.
I just want to mention to anyone that happens to be listening, we had an issue with our chat room crashing, and I'm trying to get it up right now, and it looks like it's connecting up on this other computer. Normally we try to open the chat room about 15 minutes before each show, and it is now officially open, I believe. So if anyone attempts to chat, it should be happening for them. So just wanted to, I just typed the letter G into it. So go ahead.
All right, yeah, Dan is holding it down for the chat rooms. So I hope that works out well for everyone who wants to participate. And I'm also going to give the floor back to Dan, and he is going to fill everyone in on what's new here at the Main Street Universe. What's up with the other shows? And, all that good stuff.
Okay. We are now As those of you who have been listening for a while know, a network of three shows, not just one show. We have our flagship show on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. with me and the amazing Kevin Baird and Rhett Rune-Hillman and soon-to-be Nick Barry, our fourth co-host, as well as Thursday we have Zariana Radio, and Friday we have Walking on the Sidewalk, the Horizon Oracle's Journey. And I would like to remind you that all of our episodes can be listened to in the archive section. So that means that next week you can listen to last week, this week, on Main Street Universe in our archive section. I'd also like to remind you, send out some plugs to some friends, and then get right back to Evan. One is the Weemsbot Museum in Dumfries, Virginia, where Kevin does his paranormal investigations with his K2 testers, which him and I do have a YouTube video of that, by the way. We did some fun things, talking to some ghosts and getting little lights flickering back on and off. And he does that every Thursday. In fact, he'll be doing that later today. It's a pretty interesting historical location. Our former co-hostess, Melissa DeGenova, has a blog called The Nerdy Pagan. It's nerdypagan.tumblr.com. Also, our friend Selena Fox at circlesanctuary.org. And let us send a shouting out to Zohara Hieronymus, Dr. Zohara Hieronymus, ZoharaOnline.com. She has a new book out that she sent me a free copy of when she was a guest called Sanctuary of the Divine Presence. So feel free to visit that site and buy a copy of the book. And, of course, Esoterica, Lily Edens, has an online store still with your New Age interfaith focus, herbs, crystals, stones, oils, candles, incense, divination tools, and more. EsotericaNova.com. That's www.esotericanova.com. And back to Evan Pass.
So our first tale, or our second tale, I should say, comes to us from Japan. It's a collection called Japanese Tales, which is put out by the Pantheon Fairy Tale and Folklore Library. And they put out many great collections of folklore from all over the world. This is an excellent collection. So, this story is called Syrup. The stingy senior monk of a mountain temple made a batch of sweet syrup, guzzled some all alone, and carefully put the jug on a shelf. His little alcolyte got none. In fact, he warned the alcolyte that this stuff would kill him if he ate it. The boy badly wanted some, too, and one day, when his master was out, he got the jug down. Unfortunately, he spilled some syrup in the process and got it all over his robe and hair. But this did not discourage him from gulping several mouthfuls. When he was done, he smashed his master's precious jug into bits on a rock outside. The monk came back to find the boy crying, and so his little heart would break. "What's the matter?" he said. "Your jug," sobbed the boy. "I broke your good jug by mistake. I just didn't know what you'd do to me. So I decided I'd be better off dead. And I ate a big mouthful of that stuff you told me was poison. But it didn't work. I ate more, and when that didn't work, I tried smearing it all over my robes and hair, but I'm still not dead." The monk got no more of his syrup, and he washed his nice jug too. What a clever boy. No doubt he'd make a fine scholar. So, that's kind of a fun, you know, anecdotal tale there. I suppose there's a lesson about gluttony and, you know, especially for monks in monastic settings. But really, just a much more simple one is, if you make some good syrup, you should share it. You know, very simple.
I like that.
Share the syrup. Share the good stuff you make. Don't keep it all to yourself. Some little kid's going to get into it. He'll get into it in either case. You might as well share it with him. All right. Our next tale comes from India, from the Kashmir region. Collection that I've read from before called Folk Tales from India. And this is also this collection from the Pantheon Fairy Tale and Folklore Library. And this story is called A Malcontent Cured. One day, a dissatisfied fellow was sitting under a walnut tree, and his eyes fell upon a great pumpkin growing nearby. "Oh, God," said the malcontent, "how foolish you are. How foolish to give such small nuts to this great big tree and such immense fruit to this thin little plant. Now, if pumpkins were growing on the great big tree and nuts on the little pumpkin plant, I'd have admired your wisdom." Even as he was saying this, a walnut fell down from the tree and landed on the man's head and startled him. "Oh God," he continued, "I see that you are right after all. If the pumpkin had fallen on me from such a height, I'd have surely been killed. Great is your wisdom and goodness." So, again, short, sweet, and to the point. You know, I don't think there's anything complicated that, you know, needs to be pontificated upon. Very simple. You know, we have our assumptions about how the universe is and maybe how it should be, you know. Well, in my opinion, I think everything would be better if pumpkins grew on walnut trees and walnuts grew on pumpkin plants. Who are we to say? You know? The divine wisdom isn't ours. That's God's alone. And we should just content ourselves by knowing that it is in greater hands than ours. And thank God for that. At least I can say for myself, thank God it's not in my hands. You don't know what the universe would be like in that case. All right. Moving right along. Another tale from Folk Tales from India. And this one comes from the Bengali region. A classic tale. Might even have heard it before. It is called If God is Everywhere. A sage had a number of disciples. He taught them his deepest belief. God is everywhere and dwells in everything. So you should treat all things as God and bow before them. One day, when a disciple was out on an errand, a mad elephant was rushing through the marketplace, and the elephant driver was shouting, "Get out of the way! Get out of the way! This is a mad elephant!" The disciple remembered his guru's teachings, and he refused to run. "God is in this elephant, as he is in me. How can God hurt God?" he thought. And he just stood there, full of love and devotion. The driver was frantic and shouted at him, Get out of the way. You'll be hurt. But the disciple did not move an inch. The mad elephant picked him up with his trunk, swung him around, and threw him into the gutter. The poor fellow lay there, bruised, bleeding, but more than all, disillusioned that God should do this to him. When his guru and the other disciples came to help him, take him home, he said, "You said God is everywhere and in everything. Look what that elephant did to me. Look what it did." The guru said, "Yes, it's true that God is in everything. The elephant is certainly God. But so was the elephant driver telling you to get out of the way. Why didn't you listen to him?" You know, I always enjoy that story from the first time I heard it. So what this makes me think of is, and it's something that we say all the time, and something that is very much true, you know. Was the guru lying to his disciples? No, of course not. God is everywhere and is in everything. But is that an excuse just to, you know,
walk out in front of the highway?
You know, throw it to the wind and just say, God is in the car racing towards me. Well, first of all, you know, it's not our place to, you know, put the divine wisdom up to a test. And certainly it's in our place to, you know, put that sort of judgment value on our own lives. But really, understanding this truth is not an excuse as to give up trying. You know, it's not to say that you shouldn't have faith. It's not saying faith isn't enough. But I think what it is saying is faith is nothing without action. You know? We still have to live our lives. We still have to make decisions. We've still been instilled with this wisdom, you know, on a very deep and inherent level. Like, we know these things. We know truth. You know, it should be obvious to all of us. And to say that God is everywhere and is in everything isn't an excuse just to, you know, cease to act in this world or to be a part of it. I think that's an easy point to mistake, and, you know, that's why we have stories like this. We still have to live our lives. We still have to, be in this world.
We have a part to play.
As Dan says, we have a part to play. It's very true. You know, we may realize that existence is all a play, you know, a divine play, a piece of theater. But what good is it if no one's playing their parts? Who's entertained then? It's not going to be a good show, is it? No. Not a good show at all if everyone just gives it up and says, "Oh, it's just a play. It doesn't matter." It's the opposite. It's just a play, and it matters because of that reason. Aha. All right. What have we got next? Let's do one more from India. This comes from South India, the Tamil region, which I can tell you from firsthand experience is absolutely amazing. South India, what a beautiful place. And I think you will enjoy this story as much as I do. It's called Crossing a River, Losing a Self. A foolish guru and his 12 idiot disciples were making a pilgrimage when they had to cross a river. It was evening. They looked out at the river, and a guru said, "Stand back! This river is treacherous. She has swallowed up many people. You have to be careful. We must wait until she's asleep." Then he called one of his disciples and asked him to find out if the river was awake or asleep. They lit a campfire, and a disciple took one of the burning logs to the river, stood a few feet away, and slowly dipped it into the river. At once, the water hissed and smoked. He took fright and fled the riverbank, came panting to his guru and said, "Swami, this is no time to cross the river. She is fully awake. As soon as I touched her, she hissed like a venomous snake and smoldered with hate. She was about to gobble me up, but somehow I escaped and ran for my life." The guru said, "I'm glad you got away. We'll wait till she's asleep. We'll rest in that grove until then." While they were resting, another disciple said, "My grandfather was a great merchant. He was once crossing this river with his two donkeys, laden with sacks of salt. And do you know what that terrible river did? It was summer, and they bathed in the river and washed their donkeys. But when they reached the other shore, they found that the river had eaten up all the salt. Not a stitch was loose, and there was not a hole in the sacks. But this rogue of a river somehow looted every grain of salt. Still, my grandfather was happy that she spared his life and took only his salt. This river is a rogue and a scoundrel. I'll be glad when we're a mile away from her." Then they slept a while and woke up early in the morning. And the guru said, "Try again and see if she's still asleep." The disciple took the same log and carefully dipped it again. And the river didn't hiss this time, nor did it smolder. He ran back with the good news and said, "This is the time to cross. Hurry up and get moving. And don't make any noise. The river is fast asleep." So they held each other's hands and cautiously put their feet in the water, and step over step, they crossed the river, trembling with fear lest it should wake up and devour them. When they had crossed the other bank, they were about to congratulate themselves when one of them said, "Did all of us cross without any danger? Are we sure? This is a most treacherous river. Let's count how many we are." And he counted everyone. But he forgot to count himself. He began to wail, "Look, we are only 12. The river has swallowed one of us." The guru counseled him and asked another man to count. He also counted everyone but himself. Still another counted and came up short. Finally, the guru himself counted each one, carefully on his fingers. But he too forgot to count himself and said, sadly, "It's true, we are only 12. One of us is gone." They all began to cry and howl over the loss of their friend, though they couldn't tell who the lost one was. And they began to berate the river, calling it every kind of name. "You rogue! You scoundrel! You murderer of innocence! What have you done? You've eaten our brother and tricked us most cruelly. May you dry up. May you be filled with pits." While they were railing and mourning thus, a passerby asked them why they were in so much distress. They told them how they had lost a man to the river, and count as they would, over and over, they came up with only 12. The man saw what the problem was and said, "I'm glad you came this way. I know the arts of magic and know how to bring back the lost man in 2 minutes. But it will cost you something." At once the guru said, "You are truly a godsend. If only you'll bring back our disciple, we'll give you whatever we have." They took out all their travel money from their knots and their dhotis and gave it to him. He took the money and sent them running to get a basket full of cow dung. At once, the disciples scurried here and there in town, gathered up the dung, and brought it back. The man asked them to make a long, flat line of cow dung and made them stand in a row in front of it. Then he made them bend over and press their noses into the dung. "Now," he said, "count the number of dents you've made in the cow dung and tell me how many you are." They scrambled up and each one of them counted, and they all found exactly 13 nose marks in the soft cow dung. They were amazed, jumped with joy, and said, "We're 13 again, we're 13 again. All of us are here. One of us was lost and we found him again, thanks to the magician."
And great magic it was.
All right, all right. So, what do we think about this story here? Suppose there's a deeper meaning to it. And there is, you know, the esoteric beneath the surface. But, you know, very simply, maybe it's a lesson not to trust foolish gurus and not to be an idiot disciple.
I think it was a lesson in an amazing magical spell that I'm going to try after the show is over with the cow dung.
It is a powerful spell, Dan, and you should be careful with it.
One way to stand and be counted, or in this case, put your nose right into it. Just jump into it.
The more cow dung, the more powerful the spell.
That's right.
And the fresher the cow dung, too.
I was reserving some other descriptions that I won't go into.
Now, on a certain level, I think what this story is telling us is that we're always, you know, making assumptions about the people around us. We're always looking outward, you know. But are we ever looking inward? We take everything into consideration in this universe except ourselves. Except the person doing the counting. You know, we assume the universe is like this and like that. But do we ever step back from ourselves and realize that we're the ones making these assumptions, making these judgments, you know, saying that something's missing? Well, that's us. That's the witness. Never counts himself. And, you know, some passerby comes along and works a magical spell and we're amazed, aren't we? But it was so simple all along. We just forgot to count ourselves into the equation. So, you know, just a little bit of discretion there. You know, a little bit of common sense, a little bit of healthy skepticism. Never hurt anyone. If it can't stand the scrutiny of skepticism, you know, maybe it really shouldn't stand at all. And I don't think there's any, you know, it's not a matter of like trying to offend anyone's faith or anything like that. You know, that's not what we're saying. Oh, that's not what I'm saying. Or, you know, trying to say that, you know, this is the case for all gurus, because it most certainly is not, you know, not by any means. It's not to say that the real thing isn't out there, because it certainly is. Just to say that, for one, there's a lot of charlatans, and for another, there's a lot of perfectly well-intentioned people who are just perhaps putting them in positions they don't belong in.
Raising to the level of their incompetence, we sometimes call that.
Yes, exactly. All right, so for our next story, we're going to go to Africa. This is a collection called The African Saga. Let me find my page. Bambara braggarts. There were once three comrades. The first was named Samba Bimbiri Bambara. The second, Samba Korlankana. And the third, Samba Dogunotu. They all set out on a journey together. They came to a well. Samba Dogunatu picked the well up as if it were an ordinary jar and began to pour water from it for each of his friends to drink. Samba Bimbiri then carried the well on his shoulder. They went into the jungle to hunt elephants. Each one killed a dozen, and they ate them all that same day. Samba Korlankana met a jinn woman. He said to her, "I love you." And he married her. Then they left his companions, and he went to stay with the jinn. The latter was called Komba Gwine. She was very pretty, and no bigger than an ordinary woman. Samba Korlankana always boasted before his wife of being stronger than anyone else in the world. One day, they were arguing of this, and Kumba said to her husband, "You shouldn't pretend to be stronger than you really are. Come with me to visit my parents, and you will see." "And so I will," Samba replied. And so they set out at 6 a.m. and walked until 2. And far, very far away, they saw Kumba's father lying down on the ground. One of his knees was raised. One would have taken it for a mountain. "What's that over there?" said Samba to his wife. "Is that a mountain?" "Oh," replied Komba, "don't speak so lightly of my father. That is only his leg you see there." They walked another 4 hours before reaching the village, where Komba's father was lying. At the sight of such a big father-in-law, Samba was frightened. Kumba's three brothers, Hamadi, Samba, and Delu, were at that moment out hunting. Samba Korlankana asked in which direction he would be likely to find them. "Over there," they told him. "All right," he said, "I will go and meet them." He first met Hamadi, who had killed 500 elephants. He had tied them in a bunch and carried them at his side. "Let me carry them for you," Samba said. "You couldn't carry them. Go further on and you will find my brother." Samba Korlankana met Samba, Madi's jinn brother. Like the latter, Samba had also killed 500 elephants, which he was carrying. "Go and find my little brother," he said, in reply to Samba Korlankana's offering of help. "Perhaps you can carry his parcel for him." At last, Samba found himself in the presence of Delu. Delu had only killed 400 elephants. At that moment, when he met his sister's husband, the strap of his sandal gave way. "You cannot carry my elephants," he said. "But here, take my sandal and carry it as far as the village." He threw his sandal at Samba Korlankana, and it covered him so completely that he could not get out from underneath it. Delu joined his other brothers in the village. Their father scolded them for bringing back such poor hunt that day. "What?" he cried. "A stranger comes here, my daughter's husband, and this is all you can bring back to me to put in the couscous?" He looked about him and asked, "Where is my son-in-law?" "I met him," said Hamadi, "but I sent him on to Samba." And Samba said, "I told him to go find Delu." Delu questioned and turned, so that he had given him his sandal with a broken strap to carry. "Perhaps he is under the sandal," thought Komba. "I will go back and look." She went back at once and looked for her husband, and on lifting the sandal found him underneath. Together they returned to the village, Komba carrying the sandal, which was too heavy for Samba Korlankana's strength. The meal ready, they called Samba to eat with the others, but the calabash was too tall for him to reach the couscous. Delu, seeing his embarrassment, picked him up and set him on his knee. But Samba fell into the calabash, and Delu, taking him for a piece of meat, took him up in a spoonful of couscous and put him in his mouth. The next day, Hamadi asked, "So, what happened to Samba Korlankana? We dined together last night. What could have happened to him?" "Samba was one in Delu's hollow teeth." "I feel something moving in my tooth," Delu declared, "and I don't know what it could be." "Look and see," advised his brothers. He felt about with his finger and touched Samba Korlankana. He pulled him out of his tooth and set him on the ground. Komba Gwine came, and as soon as she saw that it was her husband's, took some water and washed him off. "You see," she said to him, "you are very wrong to think yourself better than others. But this is nothing so far. You will see more than this." "Komba," he said, "ever since we married, you have always been boasting that there is no one stronger than you. I see now that I was mistaken. What is part? I am too much afraid of your race. I want no more adventures of this kind. Return to those of your own sort." And I parted from her. While these things were happening, the other two comrades were wrangling together, each maintaining that there was no one stronger than he. While they were disputing, they came to a river. "I am the master of the waters," Samba Doganatu proclaimed. "And I command the jungle," Samba Bimbiri Bambara proudly declared. Samba Doganatu straddled the river, one foot on either bank. He stooped and dipped his hands into the water. All that came within his reach, fish, hippopotami, caimans, everything, he lifted and cooked it in the heat of the sun and ate it. Samba Bimbiri Bambara went into the jungle, and everything that he found on his way he caught, and like his comrade, he grilled it in the sun at arm's length, even though it were an elephant, and thus he ate. He reached the bank of the river. He dipped his hand into the water to steal Samba Doganatu's fish. The latter saw him, seized him, and he began to fight, going always deeper and deeper into the jungle. Fighting all the time, they came at last to a blind djinn who was guarding his field. This djinn had a sling with him, with which he hurled stones at little birds to keep them from eating his millet. He put his hand on the two Bambara, who had fallen to the ground, still fighting. He thought that he had taken hold of a pebble. He put it in his sling and hurled them far away. The two adversaries fell into a calabash in which another jinn was preparing his couscous. The jinn took them in his finger and thumb and threw them aside. They flew into the eye of a baby jinn who was suckling. The little one put his finger to her eye, weeping. She cried out that there was something in her eye. Her mother said, "Come here and let me look." But before she reached her mother, the eye had already absorbed the two bambara. "It's all over now," she said to the mother jinn. "Since these three men found their masters, no one should boast that there is none stronger than he." All right. A tall tale from Africa.
Cool. We were having some technical issues with the chat room today, so I just wanted to let people know that. As Evan can see, if you turn around here, there's chat room issue. And we have two computers in here, one of them saying there's no internet out here. The other one's connected and the show's going. So it was good that we had a backup. That was the lesson of the one crashing, was to send me to the store to fix it while I got a backup, and now it has come to pass that we've needed it. So,
wow, good call on grabbing the other laptop.
Yeah.
That could have been a little dicey.
But the chat room, you can see this is where the chat room normally is, and it's just kind of... So we can't tell if you're out there, folks, right now, but that could change in 12 seconds. You never really know with internet radio land.
That's true. And remember, everyone out there, all you listeners, please feel free to call in at any point. If you have your own, you know, humorous or absurd stories to share with us, tall tales, folklore, mythology, poetry, whatever it is, we would love to hear from you. Come on the air, share your voice with us, share your stories. And so the story we just read right now, I'm going to read another one in a little bit, which we'll be able to see some similarities there in the style, in the imagery, in the dissonance of size and stuff to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want to do right now, and this will be like the first time doing this. I've wanted to get more music worked into this show. We'll start doing this more as weeks go on. But I want to have a little interlude and share a piece of music that I made some time ago with my very good friend, Ben Zeiderwig, who was also the mind behind our intro, and you know, we've spent many hours, many a sleepless night sifting through the frequencies and, you know, finding this stuff. And
I've been there for sure.
So, and this is a project we have. Ben goes by Sketchy B, you know, the Arcata's local talent, and you can find him on SoundCloud. And this project that we've worked on together is called, of course, Zarayana. So this is a track called Interspace Shuttle. And we're now going to let you have a listen, and we're going to start this off with a little bit of music. there were three tanks on the point of a thorn. Of these, two were dry, and the third had no water. In the one that had no water, three potters settled down. Of these three potters, two had no hands, and the third was handless. The handless potter made three pots. Of these, two were broken, and the third had no bottom. In the last, they cooked three grains of rice. Two turned out raw, and the third was uncooked. They invited three guests to eat the one uncooked grain of rice. Of the three guests, two were angry, and the third could not be calmed down. The third guest, who could not be calmed down, was given three blows with a shoe. Three blows missed him, and a third did not hit him. To avoid getting beaten with a shoe, the guest fled. The host pursued him. On his way, a wild elephant attacked the host. He struck the wild elephant with his fist and broke two ribs and a half of the elephant. The wounded elephant fled, and the host chased it. The elephant ran up a tree and crawled from branch to branch and from leaf to leaf. At last, the elephant jumped down from the tree and saw a spouted cup, got in by way of the mouth, and came out through the spout. The body of the elephant got through all right, but his tail got stuck. The man who was attacking it didn't want to kill such a helpless brute and went his way. Then he saw a little girl lift the carcass of the elephant on a straw and asked her mother where she should throw it. "It's only a little mouse," said the girl. The man who was watching this said to himself, "How powerful must the father of such a girl be?" So he asked her where her father was. She said, "He is away in the jungle, grazing the oxen of 70,000 treasure carts, all tied up in a string that he carries around his waist." The man went to the jungle and saw the girl's father with 70,000 treasure carts tied around his waist. He went up to him and challenged him to combat. "All right, all right," said the father of the girl, "but we are alone here, and we'll never agree as to who is the winner. Let us find a third man to act as umpire." Just then, they saw an old woman with a bent back passing by. She had some food in one hand and a pitcher of water in the other. They spoke to her and asked her to act as umpire. "Oh, my sons, an old woman like me is not fit for such a job. But I have a grown-up son, not very far from here. He would be a better person to judge, because he carries about him, tied to his waist, a string of 70,000 camels." The combatants agreed, and the old woman put the bundle of food on top of the pitcher, which she placed on top of her head, and invited one of the men to sit on each of her hands. The man with the 70,000 carts tied them carefully around his waist and sat on one of the old woman's hands. His opponent sat on the other. Now, the old woman, when she was angry, used to threaten her son and say that she would hand them over to the Quasi's bailiff. The son saw her coming from a distance and saw the two men perched on her hands. He concluded that these were the Quasi's men. So he spread his sheets on the ground and quickly tied up the 70,000 camels in it, and he took to his heels. The neck of some of the camels stuck out of the bundle, and one of them had its tongue hanging out of its mouth. A kite, thinking it a piece of meat, came swooping down and flew away with the bundle. It was too heavy, and by the bird had to drop it. So it happened that the queen was walking on the roof of her palace, and she chanced to look up just the time when the bundle fell straight into her eye. She felt the pain in her eye, so she called for the midwife. The midwife examined the queen's eye, and to her surprise, saw 70,000 camels walking about inside. She seized the camels, one by one, and hid some of them in her pockets, and some in the folds of her dress. The queen was no longer in distress, and the midwife hurried home in delight and counted all the camels, but found only 69,999. The midwife was convinced that there had been 70,000 camels, and that she must have left one in the queen's eye. So she hurried back to the palace and examined the queen's eye, but couldn't find the missing camel. So she searched in the gram field through which she had passed, but could find no trace of the camel, and gave up the search. One day, she made some pulkis, or small cakes of gram flour, and when she tore open one, the first one that was ready, she found the camel inside, but minus its head and neck. "Where have you been all this time?" asked the midwife. "I am here," said the camel, "but my neck and head are in Agra. They will come to you in due time." Now the king of Agra had made a lovely garden, and for a time it was found that some animal ate the plants every night. He ordered a search, but the animal could not be found. At last, the king ordered the wazir himself to keep guard. The wazir did so, and he cut his little finger and put salt and pepper in the wound so that the pain would keep him awake all night. And at midnight, he saw the neck of the camel appear and eat the plants. The wazir quickly ran up and caught the neck and asked who it was. "Never mind who I am," said the camel's neck, "but take this and do as I tell you." The neck gave him a seed and said, "Take this to the king. Sow it before him in the first gari, the first hour of day. It will germinate in the second gari, grow in the third, flower in the fourth, bear fruit in the fifth, ripen in the sixth, and the fruit will be eaten by the king in the seventh." The wazir did as the camel's neck directed, and the seed was planted, and 7 garis later, a ripe watermelon was placed before the king. At that moment, some astrologers were announced. They informed the king that a tremendous rainstorm was approaching, and that unless the king and all his people took refuge in a safe place, they would all be killed. They were all alarmed. But the astrologers saw the watermelon and cried out in chorus, "This is the very thing!" So they advised that the insides be scooped out and everyone should enter it. So the king and his people and all their goods and cattle went into the watermelon, and the two halves were shut together when all were in. Soon the rain came down in torrents. And it rained for days and days and days. And all the land was flooded. And the watermelon, with the king and all his people, floated on the water. After the storm was over, the big fish that was very hungry saw the melon and devoured it. But the melon was so big, it stuck in the fish's throat. So the fish came out and lay gasping on the bank when a crane that had eaten nothing for days ate the fish. But it would not go down, and the crane fell, exhausted, and was soon devoured by a cat. which too could not move and was eaten by a dog, which also lay down, unable to leave. Now, there was a Kanjar, a wandering gypsy, whose wife was always pestering him to go and get something to eat for the family. "Don't nag me," he used to say. "One of these days, I'll find you food enough to last for 4 days. So he went out to hunt on the day that the dog had swallowed the cat. He found the dog half dead and killed it with one blow of his bludgeon and took it home in delight. His wife cut open the dog and cried out, "Why, husband dear, there's a cat inside this dog. Didn't I tell you I would bring food for 4 days? You keep the cat for tomorrow." The next day she cut open the cat and found a crane. She told her husband, who said, "Keep the crane for tomorrow." The next day she cut open the crane and found a fish. And the next day she cut open the fish and found a watermelon. And at the end of it all, when she cut open the watermelon, out came the king and his people and their cattle and the horses and all their goods. And the king gave the gypsy the piece of land rent-free and lots of money and went back to his kingdom to live happily ever after. And that, my dear listeners, is called A Tall Tale from Urdu.
Aha.
A Tall Tale from Urdu. Lovely story. One of my absolute favorites. And I also love reading this story. Although, I've known about this one for a few years now, and it's always been a favorite of mine. But it took me so long be able to read the story and get through the beginning of it without busting up laughing. Mm-hmm. So this one is definitely taking some practice. And there's definitely some similarities with the story from Africa that I read before. Just in, the imagery and little girls picking up elephants like they're mice and the absurdity of it all. And that's why we love it. These are fun stories, and the sort of stories that we've been telling ourselves for a long time.
And right before we get to our next story, if this person is willing, ready, and able, we have a guest in our studio here. They don't have to say their name if they don't want, but just say hi.
Hello.
And this is her first experience with Main Street Universe Live here in Cafe Fairfax, which is, by the way, the name of this studio. What do you think of Cafe Fairfax?
Awesome.
Cool. All right, just thought I'd get that out of the way. Introductions and all that. Back to you, Evan.
Thank you, Dan. All right, now we are going to jump back to a story from Japan. And this one is called, if I can find it, Two Buckets of Marital Bliss. At a temple in Izumi Province, each trip to the bell tower took the bell-ringing monk past a statue of Gichi Joten. Everyone knows how beautiful this goddess is. Seeing her day after day was quite enough to drive every other thought from the monk's mind. He took to hugging the statue, pinching it, or even going through the motions of kissing it. In time, he dreamed he was fondling Kichi Joten as usual, on its way to the bell tower, when she suddenly moved. "My dear," she said, "I'm touched by your loving attentions. I'm going to be your wife. Go to Inamino in Harima on such and such a date, and I will meet you there." The bell ringer awoke, blissfully happy. He could see her lovely face before him. The day she had mentioned seemed so far away. Feverish with anticipation, he could hardly believe that the day would ever arrive. But when it did, there he was in Inamino, pacing impatiently up and down. At last, he saw a radiantly beautiful woman coming towards him, dressed in brilliant colors. Could she be the one? He was trembling and could not bring himself to hail her. "How nice to see you," she said when she got to him. "Now make us a house." "How am I supposed to do that?" "Why, there's nothing to it. You just get to work." A man came up to him. "Who are you?" he asked. "What are you doing out here in the fields?" "We're planning to live here," answered the monk. "But we have no house, and I don't quite know where we're going to get one from either. So I'm wondering what to do." "Say no more. You've nothing to worry about as long as I'm here. I'll get your house built. Wait, and I'll bring some men." The man was soon back with a good crew of workers. Each brought a joust or a beam, and everything else that was needed just kept coming while they worked. Some of the materials apparently belonged to the workmen themselves, while some seemed to have been purchased by the lady. At all events, a beautiful house quickly rose in the spot. Beside himself with joy, the monk led his lady in and lay down with her. "I'm your wife now," the goddess reminded him. "If you love me, you mustn't get involved with anyone else. For you, I am the only one. Remember that." Even if she had been a perfectly ordinary woman he happened to be fond of, he would hardly have objected. But under the circumstances, he agreed with all his heart. "Of course," he promised, "I wouldn't dream of wandering away from you." "Thank you, my dear," said the goddess. He began growing rice and found that even the least plot he worked gave more than anyone else's whole farm. Every comfort was his now, and in fact, he was the richest man in the whole country. People came from far away just to ask him for help, and he always gave them what they wanted. His herds of horses and cattle were vast. Finally, even the governor of the province began to defer to him and listen to his advice. After several years of this pleasant life, he had to go off for a few days on business to another country. While he was there, a retainer of his just happened to mention a very nice girl he knew of. "You could have her come and massage your feet or something, sir," the retainer suggested. "Well," thought the goddess's husband, "even if I start getting ideas, I suppose it doesn't really matter as long as I don't actually do anything with her." "Fine," he said. "I'll try her." The girl arrived, dressed to kill. He had her begin working on his feet, but one thing led to another, and soon they were a lot more intimate than that. Not that he had fallen in love or anything, but he did keep her by him as long as he was on the trip. His business over, he got back home to find his wife, looking very put out. "You swore you wouldn't," she said, "and now you've gone and done it. Oh, how could you?" "I'm leaving. I can't stay here anymore." He started justifying himself and making excuses, assuring her that she was still his only love. She, meanwhile, was a fish, big buckets of whitish liquid. "Here," she said, "I have saved it all since we've been together. You can keep it." Then she vanished. It was, of course. All the semen he had ejaculated into her heavenly wife. Life was never quite the same for him after that, but he was still far from poor. So he gave up being a monk for good, lived on as simply a prosperous farmer.
Actually, I wasn't seeing the lesson in that story, except for the fact that it seems like it really worked out for him. I don't really know what else to say.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure. Or even
is there a moral to
that
story?
Really. I
cheat on your wife, and you still kind of get the riches, and you still got to have the beautiful wife and the girlfriend. I like this story a lot. There's great wisdom in this.
You know, he just went on to be a prosperous farmer.
Unless you don't like farming, I guess.
I wonder what he did with those two buckets of white liquid, though. I'd be proud, you know.
That this is right now.
That's
a G-rated show. So that would be a. We would have to change it to a different rating, I think.
All right. Let's see. Where are we at now? Got one more story for y'all.
All right. I'd like to remind everybody listening to Zariana Radio, this is Main Street Universe, Main Street Universe Network. And your host is Mr. Evan Pass, and guest in studio, who will remain nameless for now.
All right. Our final story for the day comes from the Punjabi region of India. And this is called Two Jars of Persian. A long time ago, when the Durranis had conquered the Punjab, there was a small village where only weavers lived. The Durranis spoke Persian, and the weavers knew only Punjabi. So the villagers had a hard time. When the officers collected revenue, the villagers couldn't explain their accounts or present their complaints. They had to take everything lying down and pay up. So the weavers called a meeting, and they agreed that they would all contribute 10 rupees for a common fund to send two of their wisest men to Kabul or beyond to bring back a supply of the Persian language. No sooner said than done, two old graybeards, whose wisdom was legendary among the weavers, set out on a long journey. They trudged past the city of Peshawar and went through the dark Khyber Pass to get the precious commodity. At every village, they stopped and anxiously asked, "Have you any Persian for sale?" In every village, they were laughed at or ignored and hooted away. They finally arrived at the town of Jalalabad and met at the gates a rather clever and heartless man. "We want to buy some Persian for our village," said the weavers. The man knew at once they were great fools, and he could gull them and take their money. So he said, "Of course, of course. Come with me. If you're willing to pay the price, I'll get you two jars of the choicest Persian." Then he took them home for the night and gave them supper. It was the time of year when wasps hang their nests from the beams. So this man put some sweet things into a couple of jars and filled them with black wasps, tied the mouths of the jar with cloth, and sold them to the travelers, saying, "Be careful not to open the jars on the way and let the Persian escape. Keep them safely sealed. They are full to the brim with Persian. When you get home, call everyone together on a Thursday go into a dark room, close all the doors and windows, and take off all of your clothes. Then open the jars. Everyone will get a share and be satisfied. The two weavers then left for India with the precious jars. As soon as they arrived home, they called their neighbors together, told them the good news, and displayed the jars full of wonderful Persian. They couldn't wait to get into a dark chamber, take off their clothes, and open the jars. Once the imprisoned wasps were released, they flew all over the place and stung the villagers as they groped around the walls, crying, "Where is the door? Where is the door?" At last, the door was found, and they all escaped into the open air. They could hardly recognize each other. Their features were stung and swollen. One of them missed his mother and asked where she was. They said, "Your mother ran away, with a great deal of Persian sticking to her." So they went in search of her and found the poor old thing stung so badly that she became quite ill and took to her bed. After this experience, the weavers of the village decided never again meddle with Persian, and to leave that language to those who were cunning enough to master this strange language. And that is two jars of Persian.
I like that part of today's theme is a lot of people being led by sort of
dubious characters.
Dubious characters, even fake wise men at some point earlier in the story, or not fake, just not particularly adept shamans such. We can't all be a great shaman, I guess. There's stages. There's practice.
Mm-hmm. You know, and there's something to just having humility and not assuming that we know more than we know.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think we're going to do one more story for the day.
Okay.
And we're gonna keep the theme going here. This one comes from the Bengali region, and it is about Gopal Bhar, who is a jester in the Maharaja's court from medieval India. So there's a lot of stories told about Gopal Bhar. You know, he's a classic folk character in North Indian stories. And this one is called Gopal Bhar, the Star Counter. One day, the Nawab sent word to the Maharaja that he wanted the whole earth measured from side to side and from end to end, and that he would greatly appreciate it if the Maharaja would take it upon himself to count the stars in the sky as well. The Maharaja was astounded and said, "I don't want to seem uncooperative, but you have commanded me to do the impossible." And the Nawab said, "But do what you will." So the Maharaja fell to a brown study and brooded over how he might fulfill the demands of the Nawab. It was not long before Gopal Bhar passed by, and seeing the Maharaja in such a state of despair, he tugged gently at the ends of his mustache and said, "Maharaj, what is this I see? If you have troubles, you need only to tell your Gopal, and all will be well." But the king was not so easily consoled. He said, "No, Gopal, This is a problem even you cannot solve. The Nawab has commanded me to measure the earth from side to side and from end to end. And even if that weren't enough, he wants me to count the stars in the sky as well. But Gopal Bhar was not dismayed. He said, "Ha, Maharaj, nothing could be easier. Appoint me, your official earth measurer and star counter, and set your mind at rest. And when I am through, I shall myself go to the Nawab with the results. Only one favor. Ask the Nawab for 1 year to finish the job and 1,000,000 rupees for operating expenses. In 1 year's time, I'll bring him the results." The Maharaj was greatly pleased and relieved, since if the job were not done, it would be Gopal's head that would come off, and not his own. He did as Gopal asked. So, Gopal passed a very pleasant year, spending 1,000,000 rupees on the most delightful women and the most delicious food in the kingdom, as well as on palaces and elephants and jewels and other things of that type. He spent, in fact, such a pleasant year that at its end, he went to the Maharaja again, jingling the 4 nickel coins and 2 coppers that remained with 1,000,000 rupees, and assuming a worried frown, said, "Maharaj, the task is more difficult than I have anticipated. I've made an excellent start, this is true, and the results are promising. But I'll need another year's time, and incidentally, 1,000,000 rupees. Operating expenses." The Maharaj reluctantly petitioned the Nawab, and the Nawab reluctantly granted the extra year and a 2,000,000 rupees. And Gopal passed his year even more pleasantly than the first, since now he had some experience in these matters. Exactly 1 year later, to the hour, Gopal came dragging himself up the road to the Nawab's palace. With him were 15 bullock carts crammed to creaking with the finest thread, tangled and jumbled and matted and flattened down, and 5 very fat, woolly sheep. He led this odd procession through the gates of the palace and into the court of the Nawab, made a deep and graceful bow, and said, "Your Excellency, it has been done as you have ordered. I have measured the earth from end to end and from side to side. Yes, I have counted the stars in the sky." "Excellent. And now, give me the figures. The exact figures." "Figures, Your Majesty? Figures were not in our agreement. I've done exactly as you have commanded. The earth is as wide as the thread in the first 7 bullock carts is long. And it is as long as the thread in the other 8 is long. There are, furthermore, just as many stars in the sky as there are hairs on these 5 sheep. You have no idea. It took me such a long time to find sheep with just the right number of hairs." The Nawab could only say, "Impossible! I cannot measure that thread or count those hairs. Still, You have lived up to your end of the bargain. Here's your reward. 1,000,000 rupees. And so, Gopal lived in ease for some time longer. And
this is my money sound. Every time you say rupees.
We have a good money sound effect here. That
drums and egg shakers.
And yes, that is Daniel Michael producing our wonderful sound effects. Drums, rupees, you got it all. And I really like how it's been working out doing the sound effects. I think it's really fun and definitely gives a lot of added texture to our storytelling.
And getting the elephants and caravans in this little studio was difficult too, but we managed to pull it off.
You know, I was looking at the size of your studio here, Dan, and especially the size of your door. I really didn't think they would fit, but yeah, we've managed. We've got 70,000 camels in here, 70,000 oxen treasure carts. We've got many hundreds of elephants, 5 woolly sheep, 7 bullock carts full of thread. Yeah, quite a bit else too.
If you look closely at these, the soundproofing, of course, this is radio and not visual, but especially, like, say, at that one, it almost looks like, you know, those statues, those faces. See, if this was the lips, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the simple eyes.
You're going to have to visualize here, folks.
But, so there's a lot going on here, as he said.
Yeah, and trust me, it hasn't been easy keeping these elephants quiet while we're trying to do our show, either.
Okay.
All right, so if there's anything else, Dan, that you have to tell our listeners of the Main Street universe?
Chat room is still down and hasn't been up all day, folks. I apologize. I know in this modern internet radio era, it's actually more popular for people to chat in the chat room than to call. In the 1990s, you had the talk radio revolution. And most people now, they're like, well, they can sort of get that same thing out of the chat. So I apologize that the chat room just has not been working today. We had a few technical glitches, technical difficulties. And I say we end the show with the discussion, just because I feel like it today. We haven't done it in a while. Of a card.
All right, folks. Dan is pulling out the tarot. He's shuffling.
Does anybody have a question? Any kind of question.
How many stars are in the night sky?
How many stars are in the night?
I'm glad you're doing this, because I've wondered it for a long time.
Oh, my gosh.
What'd you pull?
2 of Swords, which means indecision. Don't really know. Can't commit to that answer. I'm sorry. And not even the tarot could answer that question for us and gave us a 2 of Swords. As an answer. So we're coming down to about 1 minute here.
You're telling me there's a question that the tarot cannot answer? Or are you telling me that that's the only answer to the question?
Well, the next card being the Queen of Cups means I think emotional wisdom should prevail here, because the show only has about 60 seconds left. So how about...
And all the stars in the sky fit into the cup of the Queen?
That's right. If you let it. Let your cup be full. And remember that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. This has been Dariana Radio.